Welcome to Explore Words, Discover World podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, speakers Daniel Levy, Dr. Miriam Francois, Professor Paul Rogers, and Chair Akhil Ahmed explore the potential for transformative change as some of the world's largest economies, India, the United Kingdom, France, and the United States, head to the polls in 2024. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, this episode offers an overview of the elections and their potential to influence the future trajectory of global politics and economics.
Now, sorry, my name's Akhil Ahmed and welcome to the Bradford Literature Festival. I'm going to be chairing it, as you can see, because I've got this incredible gold chair, which is what we should always have when you're chairing something. I'm a broadcaster and a professor and also on the board of the Bradford Literature Festival, and we have an incredible panel today because we're going to be talking about the year that is the crazy year already, that is 2024, in which we're looking at around about 4 billion people in the world will be eligible to vote. So from elections from India all the way across to something that may be happening in a few days here, all the way to America and possibly even in Israel and other countries, that this has never been a time when we can think about such change in my generation. The change that we're probably going to be experiencing this year through the ballot box, as opposed to through bullets and bombs, it's going to be very interesting to see what that world will become, and also for us to kind of look into the crystal ball and say, what do we think we may see, or what maybe we would like to see as well. So we've got an incredible panel for that. I'm going to ask Paul Rogers to introduce himself.
I'm Paul Rogers. I was a professor in peace studies at Bradford. I retired some years ago, but still keep my hand in with it. And really enjoy the festival. I met Seema before the first festival was ever held, and I sort of come to all of them since. And it's a marvellous thing for Bradford, and I'm sure it's the main reason we got the City of Culture next year.
Oh, well, no comment. As a broadcast consultant for City of Culture in 2025, I can't comment on that because I'm conflicted in both ways.
Right.
And then we have Daniel Levy.
I'm Daniel Levy. I'm having a war with the wire behind my mic at the moment. I head up something called the US Middle East Project. I am from here, lived for a number of years in Israel, and served in an official advisory and negotiating capacity there for some time. Lived in Washington, D.C., heading up Middle East work, a couple of think tanks there, with my good friend and colleague Amjad Atallah, who's somewhere in the room, or was. There he is. And now back here, but doing that from here. Headed up Middle East at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and if we get too deeply into India, then I'll display my ignorance on that.
And we have a fantastic speaker, an academic and journalist and presenter, Dr. Miriam Francois.
Thank you very much. I'm a filmmaker, journalist, and up until a couple of weeks ago, the presenter of The Stream on Al Jazeera. I've covered particularly the French elections over the last decade or so. We've also covered this big question of the elections happening around the world on The Stream, so do check out that episode.
Well, I'm going to kick off then with that, Paul, if you can set the scene a little bit and say, how unique is this year in terms of the amount of elections, or is it just simply the fact that we're in a particular period with a growth of nationalism, wars happening around us, what looks like the breakdown in civil kind of like relationships of the UN's power, etc. Is it that's the issue, or is it the fact that we have so many people voting at one time in one year?
Well, if I just start off with a very few remarks, I think your last point is the main one. There is something of a coincidence, and that means there is a focus on electoral processes, inevitably. And that, of course, is interesting, it's significant. There's two other points I would just make to start off with. One is that as the elections progress, they are not necessarily having the results that people expect. And it's interesting that, or else they're having results which may not fit into the overall pattern. In terms of the sort of the rise, if you feel like, rightist populism, that doesn't fit in with the election in Mexico at all, which has really, if anything, gone the other way. If you look at the sort of developments in India. I think for most external analysts, and Daniel no doubt can tell us much more about this, it was unexpected that Modi didn't get a clear majority. What that means is difficult to say, but that at least I think is something which was simply not expected. You have the total uncertainty in the United States at the moment, changing even in the last 36 hours. We simply don't know where we'll be there. I think that basically things aren't happening in quite the pattern. I mean, I think it would be absolutely right to say, well, it looks like it's going to be generally a move to the right. It's not turning out quite that way, and there's a lot of uncertainty. But the other thing, and those of you who know where I'm coming from, you're just going to have to live with this. The one thing is, you have an election which involves, what, 400 billion people. Four billion, get it right. And I did a science degree. I did a science degree.
Something we don't know for.
No, I did a science degree, for heaven's sake. No, the big thing that comes to me is that in none of those elections to speak of is the biggest issue facing the globe anywhere appearing, and that is climate breakdown. It's just not there. It's quite astonishing. That really needs to be discussed in some way. I don't know whether this is a venue. It's basically the elephant in the room. We're going on blithely, and we're actually seeing the beginnings of actual breakdown. And there's just not the political leadership, and there's not yet the public pressure. We have the science. The climate scientists are absolutely clear about what's going to happen, but people are not taking any notice of it. And this year could have been the year in which that might have changed, but not yet. We hope, possibly, that with the next COP being in Brazil at the end of next year, that may be an opportunity for things to change. But if not, we're in for a very rough time, which will overshadow all the other concerns that we have, and there are many.
Well, sure, it will come up in the conversations as well. But Miriam, I mean, how important do you think this year is? What would you like to see at the end of it? In terms of a realistic approach of what we think would come at the end of this year.
What would I like to see? Well, look, it's really not about me, but I will say that I think that we are, I don't necessarily share the optimism about it being a mitigated verdict in terms of the outcomes of these elections. You know, are the left actually going to win out in the end? I'm obviously closely looking at this country, the US, France, India, and, you know, it's not looking great, to put it mildly. In France, we are more than likely, according to the polls, going to be looking at a situation of cohabitation with the far right. It's the first time that we would have the far right in power since the Nazis occupied France. So, lots to be optimistic about, not. The person who is likely to become our prime minister, Bardella, is 28 years old. Not to say you can't be 28 and talented, but, you know, let's be real about this. He's a 28-year-old fascist. He is dangerous. He is a dangerous man. The party he represents is extremely dangerous. And I would say that the reality that we are going to be, in all likelihood, facing a coalition in which Macron is required to govern with him, is not an enviable future for any country. Before we even get to the logistics of trying to govern,
well, we'll go through some of the countries individually after.
Yeah.
But Daniel, how do you see 2024? You know, is it, as Paul said, there are kind of like coincidences, or do you think that this is a moment where we'll look back on, historians will look back on 2024 as a turning point?
I think they're more likely to see it as part of a continuum where the wheels have come off Western democratic politics, and that will look even more transparently the case in what I think is the overarching framing, which Paul shared some of it with us, literally fiddling while not just Rome, but the entire world burns. And I think the other framing is Western, an American especially, imperial decline. And that is incredibly dangerous. And so I think we'll probably find the headlines outside of those political outcomes, but something Miriam referred to, is also important because it's hard to know what to do with it, which is, I think, you now have a system where essentially as a public, we know we're being treated with contempt as idiots by those who ask us every few years for our votes. We're also increasingly aware that they're not going to change much in the face of big tech, what was always there in terms of corporate governance, but it changes now in terms of the nature of media, the nature of technology. The military-industrial complex was always there, but it feels less and less like that is going to change things. And yet, somehow we've got to swallow hard and acknowledge that it does make a difference if it's Nigel Farage or Keir Starmer, right? It does make a difference if it's the Le Penists, and I still haven't got his name into my head, the 28-year-old.
Bardella,
yeah. And I definitely wouldn't have said it that well, so yeah. Even if I had got his name into my head. Yeah. It does make a difference. And, you know, you had the Greens are in power in Germany, and they have become one of the most warlike, anti-environmental, neoconservative parties in the world, and yet it matters whether it's them or the AfD. So I actually think that something like the setback to Hindutva and to Modi in India might end up being the positive silver lining headline rather than any of the things we're looking for in the West. And I also look at what's just happened in Kenya. And I say to myself, you know, can publics outside of electoral systems, because they had an election in Kenya, but something that was going to really impact people's living standards was challenged on the streets, and that was victorious on the streets. And so, you know, we have to process that stuff because it seems to me to matter a lot.
And Senegal obviously saw elections where somebody who'd been in prison is now the president. So, you know, there are openings potentially, but I don't, yeah, I think it's not a very hopeful future. And I think that the reality is that most of us are looking at once again this, you know, by this polar system where we're given the options between two choices nobody actually really wants at a time where we have never needed more radical solutions to extreme crises in our midst.
No, I think you're right. Should we start then with that, with the election where they have two candidates that not many people really want in America? And of course, it's linked, because I think it's linked to the, as you said, I think you're completely correct, you know, linked to the kind of like the decline in the kind of in the American empire. You know, we always said, you know, I once made a film about it where we had this incredible line from one of the academics who said, the American empire, it was never really an empire because they never sent their second sons to go and live in a foreign country. They wanted to do it on a six-month attachment. So it's not. That's why it was never really the real kind of empire in that sense. But
well, except in Israel, where of course they did settle en masse and continue to settle en masse.
Well, later on, but yes. But in terms of America, the two people. Well, one person in particular. But are we going to see these two particular people that are on the ballot now? Are they going to be on the ballot in November, Paul?
I don't know enough about American politics to say. I mean, given their age, either of them could fall ill. And in fact, looking at him, I think Trump is probably the more likely. But no, so leaving aside that, I think quite probably. But I would have said we'll know within a fortnight whether Biden will stand. I mean, he's determined to at the moment. That may change. Got to just raise one other thing. We're talking about the global things. The other thing I think we have to factor in right at the start is this is an increasingly militaristic age. The Stockholm Peace Research Institute reported that for the first time, world military expenditure this year has hit $2 trillion. And you know, it's going up in many countries. It has this extraordinary position, we talked about it earlier today, that this is Armed Forces Day in Britain, and you have our dear friend Sunak and Starmer each going to military-type establishments to say how much more they're going to spend on defence. Sorry, on the military one, you shouldn't use the term defence. So essentially, that is also happening. It's an incredibly good time. I mean, talk about now thrive the armourers. This is the best time to be in the arms trade by far. So I'll just add that in now. But on the American side, I would see what my colleagues think. I want to hear what they say about this.
Daniel, how realistic is it that Biden's going to stand? And does it really matter anyway if one of them, whoever wins?
What you just said, Paul, made me think they may not have sent their sons to settle, but they did send their poor and their immigrants to fight and invade faraway countries in the US. So that kind of matters. The thing is, you came into this, and I think it's remarkable, that just the optics, I watched it, I stayed up all night and watched the 90 minutes. And, you know, I don't feel it's 90 minutes I'll never get back in my life. I feel I wouldn't have watched the whole 90 minutes, and you had to absorb just the madness of the spectacle in front of you. I mean, there was that guy in the UK election debate which said, is this the best?
Are you the best too? We can ask.
Best question asked in this debate.
Well, on steroids, if you watch the American presidential debate, I mean, really, they compared to those two. But we came into this election, I think, with America already deep in crisis, structurally, systemically, because it's a system where, given the nature of the Senate, this is long-standing stuff, right? You have states with tiny populations that have the same power. So the votes are already completely disproportionately spread at the Electoral College to that. And, of course, money in American politics. So that old adage, it's the best democracy money can buy. But, you know, you suddenly wake up one morning and read that a scion of the Mellon family in Pennsylvania dropped $50 million on the Trump campaign. The last election cost $14 billion. This one will surpass that. You just had a primary in New York 16th? 16th. Where one of the squad, Jamal Bowman, gets blown out of the water on Israel lobby money. Not people from, not on any of his policies. The competing candidate didn't run on this issue. But because of something called independent expenditure campaigns, you can put any amount of money into a primary, into the general, and then you bring in the two particular characters.
The puppets.
Well, this is the thing. I even blanch at saying that, because if the puppet masters cared to put on a good puppet show...
This has been the question. People have posed this question. Yeah.
So at least if you thought Wizard of Oz, you could peer behind the curtain and there'd be something there. I think the question today is there anything there other than a mess and a set of deep nefarious interests which don't even give a damn that this looked like a proper puppet show anymore? Personally, I think it would matter if the Democrats could replace Biden, because of what he has done on Gaza especially. I can't hide my contempt, but he can't hide the fact that he is a candidate for whom the idea that you can seriously go to your electorate and ask people to vote for him. I mean, but the question about whether he'll stand or not, and I think this is the key, and it may well be decided, Paul, in the next 2 weeks, yeah, because they're gonna take the temperature. But it apparently is going to come down to a decision made amongst this tiny cohort of power brokers inside the Democratic Party. This is the guy standing on the ticket, the other one's a threat to democracy, right? There's been no contested election to put him there. Whether he is on the ballot will come down to power brokers. I mean, we're literally trying to work out Kremlinology style. Like, we try and understand what's going on in Tunisia behind the throne of Saeed Qais, and that's what's going on in America. But this is supposed to be the shining beacon, so that's my optimism.
Will it make a difference, Miriam?
Well, I share a lot of what Daniel was saying, to be honest, and I think that there's a couple of things. There's the fact that Gaza in particular, I think, as the onslaught has gone on now for coming up to 9 months, right, we have seen various uses of public pressure in this country and there to try and influence the political process, right? The people have spoken, there have been polls, there have been protests, there have been resignations, high-level resignations. There's been dissent. You know, I did a show on dissent in DC, whereby there are now a group of anonymous staffers within Washington who are a rebel group within the administration. I mean, that's what we're talking about. And even with this, we have seen zero budge from Biden specifically, because I think at this point, clearly, that, you know, the buck stops with the president and in the system. However, having said that, you know, I sort of jokingly referred to puppets, because I remember reading in Obama's autobiography, when he was discussing the Israel-Palestine conflict, him saying that he very quickly realized that he had very little leeway, very little space to actually move. And so it's news to no one, of course, that the US political system functions on the basis of lobbying and basically money. Who can pay off the candidates gets to influence the outcome. And so at a time where we have seen significant popular movements, whether it's the Me Too movement, and then a few years after that, we see a reversal of Roe versus Wade. We see the BLM movement, a massive popular movement. And in the same, just a year after that, we see the highest number of black people being killed at the hands of the police. We are seeing mass mobilization over Gaza, and we see policies completely to the other end of that. So what we are seeing is essentially the unmasking of the pseudo-democracies in which we live in.
What comes next, then? Because I've had this conversation with many people who said, obviously, that young people in America are feeling very different, particularly the Democratic Party, and both parties are a split. The old Republican Party is being taken over by some Tea Party, far-right kind of act, you know, thing. And the Democratic Party, Biden, is he really reflecting what a lot of his grassroots supporters and campaigners really want to see, but not just in Gaza, but in other places as well? So what comes next, then?
On that particular point, I think, you know, there are some interesting parallels with France. I think that the Democrats have been lazy. I think they looked at the Republicans under Trump and said, no one's really going to vote for that. And so they got a bit lazy about actually addressing the grievances that Trump specifically addresses, which incidentally, you know, whatever your views on Trump are as a person, he is clearly speaking to real grievances that people have. Whether or not his diagnosis of the solution to those problems are real is another issue. Just as the far-right populists across Europe are tackling real issues that particularly working-class communities are facing, and that previously working-class orientated parties on the left have basically left to the wayside because they're so focused on the middle class. I had a conversation with David Lammy, which I'm sure he won't mind me making public, very recently about this very issue, where he said to me, and I'm sure he doesn't regret it now, that their focus as the Labour Party wasn't the working class, that the votes to be won would be with the middle class. And so from the moment that the Labour Party of this country abandons the working class, it is no longer worthy of that name. And I'd say there's a similar issue in terms of how the Democrats have operated. So
what we've seen in France, obviously, is the Macron-type, independent-type approach. Well, I say independent, but not the established kind of political parties. The fracturing of them, and you have Macron, who's more of an individual initially. Are you saying that in America, well, that's likely to happen? Or would there be some kind of realignment or a rebirth of any of these political parties?
Well, so I'm saying that in France, particularly in the last presidential election, the Socialist Party, which previously has governed France, by the way, we have a strong socialist history, received, I believe, 8% of the vote. The actual far left did better than the Socialist Party in France, which is an indication to you of how poorly they have...
But what that means is that what I'm trying to get at is actually established parties, either they fail. If you look at the British electoral system, you know, the Liberal Party was up to the First World War, was regularly in government, regularly running the country, and then had one more stint a few years ago, which you probably regret now, the new version of the Liberal Party. But effectively, new parties came, and the Labour Party was the new party which came along and usurped them, and then the Liberal Party has morphed into all sorts of different things over the years. Yeah. Do we think that's what will happen in America? That actually the Democratic Party will and the Republican parties will split in two, or new parties will come, or will they rebuild and just and people will get lost in the middle somewhere. Daniel.
I think it's to the US expert.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, a lot has to be seen through the lens of peculiarities of any country's political system, right? So, no, third parties have not succeeded in breaking through. In America, you don't break up as a party. You fight within your own party. So that Tea Party insurrection inside the Republican Party builds into the MAGA phenomenon, and it's dominant now. On the Democrat side, I'm more hopeful.
Though, Daniel, if you're centre right, as it were, if that's the way to describe it, if you're a traditional Republican, then where do you go if you have someone like Trump and politics, which you just look at and say, no, not for me. But then you may look at the Democrats. I mean, some may go to the Democratic Party because they look at Biden and say, yeah, he probably looks like an old-fashioned Republican. But where do you go if you can't do that? Do you just hold your nose and vote for Trump, or are you lost to the system?
Daniel, am I not right in thinking that in America, majority of US voters don't vote? They vote party. They're party politically faithful. As in, you know, in this country, we might pick a leader. As in, we might say, OK, I'll vote for Labour because of Starmer, or not.
I would say it's the opposite in America, isn't it? Because you're actually voting for the candidate in the presidential elections. More than in here, you can hide.
In America you have the option to split your ticket. So you vote for the presidential candidate. You vote for every time there's a presidential election. You're going to be voting for your member of the House, and then depending on when
but
your Senate.
But about the presidential election. In the presidential election, you it's not necessarily that you're voting for the party. You could vote for the candidate.
Yeah, but you have the opportunity to split. So, for instance, there will be I imagine, and I'm looking at my two American friends in the room for reinforcement here, I imagine there will be a cohort of people who won't vote on the presidential part of the ballot and will vote Democrat down ticket. And that might be true on the Republican side as well.
But still, though, if you want a president... Right, because it's actually that's who's going to.
But there's a more fundamental question of how much are people seeing change in their life through the lens of who they vote for, and the centrality of this periodic exercise in marking an X on a ballot paper. And I think we are failing to create a sense of, well, look, we're not just failing. We're being ever more circumscribed in our ability to protest, in our ability to try and drive change in other ways. And what ways are we going to find? And I think there's a problem when, and as you said, you know, people have real, there are real issues. And this is also a failing on the left, for sure, that we kind of sometimes think, well, A, either, oh, don't be silly. How could they vote for that ridiculous person, whether it's a... you know, an elderly Trump or a 28-year-old. But we also, I think that, well, I've won the argument now, I've called you a racist. Okay, right. It's done now. Rather than unpacking what it means that person doesn't have solutions. It's not that their position on immigration is racist or not, and it probably is racist, but that's not where the argument is won and where the argument ends. It's what does austerity do? It's why have our standards of living dropped for most people? Why do then people then refract that through the lens of that person take my job? And here's the alternative answer to that. And the thing is, the answer is almost certainly not going to be the box-ticking exercise of technocratic, bureaucratic approaches that most people tend to offer the public. And I think that's where things are really coming apart.
And I think to add to that is what is happening in the closest election, which is in 5 days' time.
Well, here. I was just going to come to that and say, so where do people go if you know?
Well,
because of what he's done in Gaza.
I think there are things to unpick here, and I'd actually start with the election in 2017, because it's worth remembering that 3 weeks before that election was to be held, the Conservatives had a lead of about 21% over Labour. When the election was held, it was down to 4%, and they were no longer the largest party. That is not happening in reverse this time. but I think there are other things which are happening are significant. If you like, the powers that be, let's use that general term without in any way wanting to be conspiratorial, the powers that be got one hell of a shock in what happened in 2017, because Labour came within 3 days of getting into Downing Street with a very unusual set of policies, which individually were very popular, incidentally. And the point is they didn't. Corbyn has gone, Labour has been reclaimed, but it's been much more than reclaimed. I think what has happened with Labour is that it has deliberately moved, certainly to the centre-right, probably even more than that. And it's determined to stay there. What has gone on within the Labour Party is quite astonishing in terms of getting rid of any people who didn't toe the line. You know, I talked to one MP who's very much involved in this a few months ago, and he said that every left-wing Labour MP was keeping their head down the whole time, not giving any excuse to be deselected. And apparently there was a very strong view, backed by a lot of evidence, that this summer period was going to be the period when the purge would really happen. But of course, Sunak mucked that up because he called an early election, which means that you're going to have a rump in Labour, probably about 40 MPs who do not want to toe the party line. But the much more important thing is that if Labour now gets in and gets in comfortably and is really pretty solidly right, then there's going to be a huge number of people disenfranchised. I mean, we have the added problem of Gaza. You know, the feelings among so many Muslim communities
Not just Muslims.
That's what I'm going to say. It's huge, but it is not just Muslims. It really isn't. You know, if you look, I have a friend, an Arab-Israeli friend, Israeli-Arab friend, who actually has attended most of the demonstrations in London. I think he's attended 15. None of them was less than 100,000 people. At least one was over 1 million. And of course, it was a huge mixture of people. I've been to one or two of the smaller ones around here, and it's a complete mix, you know. But that is reflecting what's happened to the Labour Party. There are a lot of very angry non-Muslims in the Labour Party right across, and they will be thoroughly disenfranchised. Now, after 2017, many of them, well, at least after when Starmer got in, many of them turned to other sorts of community politics. But that's not going to be enough in the longer term. So I think I have a major problem of representation in Britain, in Labour, which is not going to be easily healed and may fact in a range of new developments. Yeah.
Paul, can I throw one thing into the mix there, which is we may also see a situation in which there has never been such a gap between the percentage of the popular vote and the size of the majority in Parliament in this country. And that's a recipe for real problems.
Yeah.
Well, on that, what do you think, Paul, is actually... Because there is an argument, if Starmer does get a huge majority, then it will be he can do what he likes, right? Now, if he has a smaller majority, he may have to be a little bit more conciliatory and actually and maybe reach out to people that actually they've bypassed and kicked out of the party, and some may argue in Bradford and many places like Bradford, or voters, particularly in the Muslim community, feeling that they've been completely ignored and taken for granted. Is there a magic number, or do you think ultimately he is on a mission to actually turn the party into the centre-right party, which will and he's seeing it as an opportunity to usurp the Conservatives, who are going to go through a generation of kind of tearing themselves apart?
I think that's certainly true. In fact, I'm not even sure it's going to be centre-right. I mean, it might be further than that. But essentially, as far as Labour is concerned, I think Starmer needs preferably 60-seat plus majority, ideally. Anything less than about 30%, 30 seats, does give him a problem. But the chances are he's going to get that, which means that... And, of course, Labour is not answering the fundamental problems that face us. And that takes us into all the neoliberal thing and the rest. But the point is, it's not. So the chances are, whether you like it or not, Labour is going to fail in terms of giving people hope. You know, you were saying earlier on about the whole business about the expectations of people that things need to get better, the need for hope. The point is, if Labour fails on that within the first 2 years, then I was at a smallish meeting in London, and one of the speakers was Caroline Lucas, who was speaking very freely. This was just on Tuesday. And she was saying the thing that she feared most was that if Labour fails, this will really give the opportunity for the far right to really develop and strike, so that you actually get a really far-right government in, say, 3 or 4 years' time, or maybe 5 years' time even.
How does that make you
Well, if they're the only one offering radical solutions to systemic crises, then you get exactly what you deserve at that point. If you, I just want to, so obviously the show that I've been working on is a show that's geared towards Gen Z and younger millennials. And if you're a young person, not just in this country, but across the world today, your likelihood of, once you leave school, you're leaving school with huge amounts of debt. You're unable to rent. Your likelihood of ever being able to afford a house is virtually nil. Your prospects of earning more than your parents have completely dissipated. We are among the first generations that have much, much bleaker prospects than the previous generations, than our parents' generations. We are looking at a generation that is faced with an extremely bleak future. And I don't think anyone has addressed this adequately within the political parties. Everyone is geared towards, you know, the older vote because we know the older people turn out for elections. But the reality is that the future that young people face across the globe is extremely bleak. And no one is putting forward policies apart from those who claim to have found the solutions in far-right solutions. Well, the reason that there are no jobs for you is because there's too many immigrants. Well, they were right on the first bit, but it's not because of the immigrants. And who's going to tell them that? Because actually, Labour is just prepared to go and say exactly the same thing. And so until there is some kind of a radical shift in the political spectrum of this country, and I do mean radical, like, you know, Jeremy Corbyn had to be got rid of, and he was, let's be clear, got rid of, right? We're all very clear on the fact that Jeremy Corbyn was got rid of because of his position on Israel, amongst other things, but certainly because of his position on Israel. And we now today have a situation where the mask is off. Young people have virtually nothing to lose. What, we're going to live at home for the rest of our days? My brother is married and living at home with my parents. He works in construction. The likelihood of him ever being able to leave the family home is nil. With two people working, they can't leave the house. You are breeding a generation of young people that at this point have nowhere to go politically and less to lose. And if you don't listen, they will make themselves heard. And I can assure you that I will be at the front of trying to make sure that they are heard.
Can I? Yeah. Hopefully we'll come back out of this loop, but can I keep going down first before we before we try and work our way out of this? Because I share this sense of what a dangerous moment we are in. And it's not just kind of if the centre-left party shifts to the right, then the all of politics shift to the right. And I don't think the solutions are on the right. And let me then put it into a geopolitical framing as well. And sure, it was an election ploy and an election that they're going to lose anyway. But I really had my alarm bells ringing when Rishi Sunak put conscription on the agenda. And again, I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist or excessively alarmist, but it terrifies me that it's only at the margins of right-wing politics that we hear a critique of the geopolitical position and a questioning of where this goes to in Ukraine, and a questioning of whether, with such ease, we are sleepwalking into a potential situation where we see war on this part of our continent that is eminently avoidable. And I'm not playing Putin he's not the good player in this, okay? But to attribute motivations to that country, which I don't think there is evidence that they exist in terms of where they intend to take this. And if you add into the mix that the more wound up we get about migration, when we're living in a reality where climate migrants are going to be a major feature, and then who's going to protect our borders? Hey, wasn't there an idea in the 2024 election? I know he lost, but that conscription idea, dust that one off. It wasn't really an idea anyway. He hasn't really got a plan for it, but anyway. But I think we should be extremely worried about this, and I think it is the is one of the places that this politics can go, and it's a way of avoiding. I look at where the kind of political conversation has gone since the invasion of Ukraine, and the glee with which the people who were feeling really threatened because a generation had seized an issue which is the most crucial issue, going back to the first thing that Paul said. A generation was challenging those politicians, and it was no longer the military experts who were on telly, but it was the people who were explaining to us where our bloody planet is going. And suddenly that's totally kicked into the long grass. And I'm not saying it's a conspiracy, but it was an opportunity to seize on this and to bring our politics right back to a place that was convenient for power structures that were really challenged for the first time. And we have to regain that moment.
So that does tie into something we were just talking about in the US election, obviously, which is the fact that we are now in a world, and COVID obviously sped this up, where there is a huge inequality of wealth in the world, and with wealth comes power. And the reality is that what we're talking about, elections that are now being decided by smaller and smaller groups of more and more powerful, financially powerful people whose interests do not align with ours. They don't align with yours. They would rather send your brother to die on the front line of an unnecessary war than find a peaceful solution to it, because it continues to line their pockets, because they have interests in the military-industrial complex, which makes them millions, if not billions. And no one is willing to say that they are the problem. We have to continue to pander to this idea that the people that are in power right now, the people who are vying for power, have our interests, the majority of people in this country, at heart, and they don't. Let's be absolutely clear about this. There is nothing about Rishi Sunak's individual profile which says to me that he has any interest in what's happening in the centre of Bradford. None. And the idea that Keir Starmer has any vision for what should happen to this country that is going to systemically uproot the patterns that we are in. If you look at the Oxfam report on inequality, it's continuously highlighted growing economic inequality in this country and globally. If no one is willing to halt that, then we are headed towards a future where a smaller and smaller group of people are more and more powerful and increasingly have the technology to control and influence how you think and your scope for rebellion. And if you don't rebel now, mark my words, you will not be able to rebel more than you can now in 5 years' time. The window to speak up and to fight back is now. It is shrinking day by day. The technologies that are being developed, that are happening now at the speed of light, that the technology companies can't even keep up with, are being sold to us as emancipatory. They are not emancipatory technologies. They are control technologies. But they are connected to the ballots, because Cambridge Analytica gave us the precedent.
We're going to have to go to questions as well at some point. But I suppose when we talk about Keir Starmer, and we've said all this stuff, I mean, obviously politicians make policies and political parties make policies based on focus groups and all these kind of things. Now, we could have a very generic conversation and say, oh, it's because the media perpetuates all this stuff, which is why people believe it. If this kind of anger was so popular, and I've got to be honest with you, I've got kids in my house who are in their mid-20s, and I hear it all the time, and I completely agree, because it is exactly what I was like as well. I get that, but I think the stakes are much higher now than they were when I was campaigning against Thatcher in the 80s. But if this was so popular, then why are they going so far to the right? If everybody is going to the right in terms of politics, and we haven't got a left-wing party, or we will have a handful of left-wing independent MPs possibly, or independents linked to a particular grouping, or whatever George Galloway's grouping is called today, if it was so popular, then why does nobody want it?
Well, I think the thing here, obviously, is that as far as the party which is almost certain to form the government with a big majority is concerned, it has made absolutely sure that the people going into Parliament are not actually fully representative of the people in the country. Certainly not representative of supporters of Labour. And, you know, I look at the constituencies where I live, it's just not true. So, in other words, I mean, people are being disenfranchised in a serious way. And that, I think, is a major development for this country. And again, I think what Daniel and others have mentioned earlier on, the ability to protest. I mean, you were saying this as well, the ability to protest, you know, that Just Stop Oil may be interested in doing something at airports. And was it 20 of them arrested just a couple of days ago? I mean, my wife is actually down at a meeting to learn about non-violent direct action in Birmingham today. I'll be glad when she gets home without being part of a police raid. And that is a change. And it's, you almost sense that the, I hate the use of the term, the powers that be or the elite and the rest, but there is a sector within society which has a very considerable power, and they are worried about the way in which protests can develop. They were very worried. They're very worried about the sheer size of the Gaza protests. And you see this in coming in all sorts of ways. And that essentially is very much part of the undemocratic process, which I think is what we're facing.
So where did it go then, Miriam, in terms of the ballot box this time round? Will people who feel disenfranchised, probably it's quite a few of us in this room who feel disenfranchised, right, from the party which we may have been members of or supporters of, etc. Where did it go?
Well, unfortunately, we do know that a lot of young people probably won't vote. We also know that there have been, I don't know if it's record numbers of independent candidates being fielded, but certainly a huge amount.
Three times at the last election,
right.
450 compared with 120.
So a lot of independent candidates. And I think some people will, strategically vote Labour, not because of Starmer, but because obviously they want to keep, the Tories out of power. And, you know, ultimately that's a very personal decision for each and every person to make. But I do think that the issues that you're talking about, the fact that we are seeing, you know, people protesting something that allegedly everyone agrees is, hold on, a life-threatening, a planet-threatening, a world-threatening issue. The people protesting against measures to limit this life-threatening issue are being arrested, and we're okay with this? This is the new normal? The people protesting genocide, people protesting the lack of action on climate change, which means that your kids will be breathing in toxic air, that their futures are literally doomed. My son, who is 11 years old, I don't even talk to him about this stuff, says to me regularly, "Mom, will there even be a planet when I grow up?" He asks me this question. There is no one willing to talk about the radical solutions that we actually need. And until they do, the only solution is for people to reclaim the power starting from the streets. We have to send a strong message as the people that if the people in power won't listen, they will be made to listen. And direct action is a great way to start.
That, though, how would you do that in a sense? If they've ignored it, sadly. If that's being ignored in many countries at the moment, and you could even go, it's getting even more draconian. I mean, we've talked here about some big issues, but let's talk about the small thing of the coconut camp thing. And the woman, she's 6 months pregnant, and they take her to court over something which kind of like is like, for people of colour, it's a normal thing to call people that you don't like, et cetera, of your own race.
Say it. Yeah. Hold the placard. Yeah. Every single one of us should hold that placard.
I know, but the point I'm making is actually, how do you? Because obviously, if there is this drift rightwards across Europe, across in the West particularly, and this kind of authoritarian kind of grip on protest and whatever and political parties, then how can you realistically change it? Because has been stopped. Have you said it? It hasn't.
Daniel is the one who mentioned what had happened in Kenya.
Well, that's what I mentioned. That's what I'm asking.
Well, first time, doesn't everyone also have the ticket with Elon Musk on the flight to the other planet when it all goes belly up?
Right.
I mean, one of the things is, as I think has come across quite clearly, is a reductionist approach which takes this to what you do on election day obviously is not where this conversation needs to be. And when it comes to election day, that serves one purpose. I think you have to be able to juggle various efforts at one time. So we talked about the Biden administration. Now, Biden actually, in many respects, worked with the progressive faction within the Democrat Party, and they got some things done on domestic politics, on the IRA, not RRRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, which was the big green subsidies and energy and other things packaged, they managed to do some stuff. He didn't reverse all of what needed to be reversed on Trump and on immigration, and he's leaned in a bad way as he's come closer to election campaign. But yeah, you have to try and make change where power resides. So I think we don't give up on having finally now being on the cusp of a change of government in this country. You don't give up on trying to impact that. And I think there will be an awful lot of people elected on a Labour ticket in a few days' time who will look at the numbers of their election and understand that if they want to be elected again, then some of the people their party leadership have just royally pissed off will need to be brought back into the fold. And so from day one, it's trying to work in that space. But then there are all the other things that people have spoken about that aren't to do with the election and aren't to do with who's in power. I think you mentioned Mexico, didn't you, Miriam? Or someone mentioned Mexico.
I did.
You mentioned Mexico, yeah. Paul. So there you saw a quite radical left program win with an increased majority, if I'm not mistaken, with Claudia Sheinbaum getting elected following AMLO. And you know, I think one of the things we've got to take on board is America's going to go on its journey. We have to stop thinking about things in terms of the West and we stand. The West is finished right now in terms of being able to say, these are our values, this is the order that we need to try and push forward. Because on Gaza, if on nothing else, we don't have a leg to stand on. And we have to start rebuilding that. And by the way, the desperation that you described amongst younger people, I don't think it's necessarily true in some global majority, global South spaces. I think there is more dynamism and there is more of a sense of we can change things. I'm not suggesting we go with China's economic or political model, but China pulled 800 million people out of poverty in the last generation. So there's a need for a bit of humility, and I think most importantly, to step back from this idea that what matters is a militarism of a new geopolitical contestation around war and around lining the pockets of people who benefit from that. And that it feels to me like a linking up many of these movements is, and it's, you know, it's not my daily bread and butter, but that's what feels like necessary.
Listen, I just want to say a big thank you very much to everybody here. I think in 2025, when you come back to the festival, we'll be able to see what the 2024 elections delivered. I'm sure we'll be sat here with a panel again saying to us, well, 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 well. So anyway, look, big round of applause for a fantastic panel. And please enjoy the rest of the festival. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.